Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, a couple of days ago, something happened that has never happened in the history of ETFs. What was it?
It was the first ever ETF to convert from a mutual fund into an ETF. If you're in this fund, you would go to sleep one night with a mutual fund and wake up with an ETF, all else equal. And this was really monumental. And the first one to do it was Guinness Atkinson. But there are a couple others now lined up, including a massive one from DFA that could be about $26 billion. And it's got a lot of people buzzing. There's a lot of talk about how this could start to really spread and really become the way, as opposed to some other ways, that the traditional active mutual fund sort of comes over and it takes advantage of the ETF structure and the benefits that are in it, while being able to keep their track record and start with some assets, as opposed to try to, you know, make it on their own in the Terror Dome as a newborn, which is hard.
So this will be a fascinating conversation. And joining us from Guinness Atkinson Funds, Jim Atkinson, as well as his lawyer, Alex Albertstadt, they were the two that helped bring these two ETFs to market, Smart ETFs Dividend Builder with the ticker DIVS, and the Smart ETFs Asia Pacific Dividend Builder, the ticker ADIV. As well as at Bloomberg News, Claire Ballantyne, who wrote that story in March. This time on Trillions, converting from a mutual fund to an ETF. Jim, Alex, welcome to Trillions. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Delighted to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So this just happened in March. How long ago did you start dreaming about leaving the mutual fund world for the ETF world?
More than 2 years ago, maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago. But we started in earnest on this project, I think, about 2 years ago.
And what was the attraction?
Well, we've been in the mutual fund business for a long time. We have some great funds, and we're noticing that the ETFs are attracting all the assets. And you look at the flows, you notice that mutual fund flows have been persistently negative, and ETF flows have been persistently positive. And you look around and you say, well, there's a reason for that. And that's because ETFs are a better mousetrap. And once you conclude that, you start to say to yourself, I think we need to be in the ETF space, not the mutual fund space, but we've got some great funds. How do we convert these into ETFs? And it was a little bit discouraging at first because it had never been done before. And there were a lot of obstacles, but I talked to Alex at length about it, and we just decided to go for it. And we had a few phone calls with the SEC, and we just pushed ahead, and we just kept pushing that rock up the hill.
I want to ask about phone calls with the SEC, but I also want to bring my colleague Claire in. Claire, help set the stage for us. Like, if they were the first ones, how many more conversions are we likely to see in the days/weeks/months ahead?
Well, the big one that we know is coming up is Dimensional Fund Advisors. They're converting quite a few of their mutual funds. That's going to make them, right out of the gate, a really big ETF issuer. They've launched a couple of their own ETFs separately. But with these conversions, that's going to make them one of the largest ETF issuers just from that. And outside of just that, we've seen a couple of other smaller players file to convert their funds. One is a cannabis fund. So it's an interesting trend, and I think we're going to see it more and more.
And what stood out to you about the Atkinson one? Like, what was significant to you about it, other than being first?
Being first, definitely. And I remember last year hearing about this, and just in the middle of such a crazy pandemic year, I just remember looking at this and having observed how much money mutual funds have been losing and how much money ETFs have been gaining. I remember my first thought was like, whoa, is this possible? This is a game changer. So it's a really interesting trend, I think, and just the fact that it's possible is pretty notable.
So Jim, I'm curious about this idea of how to do it, because when we first started talking about conversions, I think it was the guy from Precidian who brought up conversions on our podcast about a year and a half ago, and he said some lawyers are talking about it. I put this out on Twitter. Some people replied, well, I don't know if this can ever happen because people need brokerage accounts all of a sudden, and it's tough to do that. What if it's in a 401k plan? How did you work out those kinks?
Well, the biggest kink was the direct shareholders. So most shareholders nowadays buy their mutual funds through a brokerage firm, but there's still some people and the legacy shareholders that hold their shares direct. And you're correct. The traditional transfer agent system doesn't permit the holding of what is essentially an equity security from an operational standpoint. And we had to do a little research to find the answer to this, but we came across a firm called American Stock Transfer, and they're a corporate transfer agency. So the way it worked was, as we got close to the conversion, we reached out to the shareholders who were direct, and we said to them, we'd like you to transfer your shares to a brokerage firm or exchange into another one of our funds. And our least preferred option was for them to redeem. And most clients came back and said, we want to transfer. And by the way, that is a whole other process we can talk about later. But we knew we weren't going to get 100% of our shareholders that were direct to transfer. So we arranged for American Stock Transfer to step in and fill the gap. So any shareholder that was on our records as a direct shareholder on the 26th of March in these two funds got transferred over to American Stock Transfer. And it's our plan to get them to move off of there into a brokerage account eventually. That was sort of a key breakthrough we had to come across because that was the operational snag that we kept bumping up against.
Alex, I want to bring you in here. Did the conversation between Jim and the SEC, did that start before you or once you were part of the team?
No, that was, Jim and I planned this structure out together. We've talked about it for a few years. We've researched a lot of bits and pieces of different transactions involving mutual funds and closed-end funds in the past, and we sort of put all those elements together. And then we did what anybody can do, which is you reach out to the SEC, you have a conversation, you explain to them what your idea, your concept is, you show them why it fits within the existing regulatory scheme that they are comfortable with, and sometimes they have questions, you respond to those questions, and eventually you get to the point where you move forward with your disclosure filings, which is what we did.
So these aren't billable hours. So I want to just ask,
going all pro bono work.
No. Not exactly correct.
But not billable for me right now, at least. So as long as I have that advantage, I just want to ask, what did you find surprising in that conversation with the SEC and throughout this process?
Well, I mean, the first surprise was, we thought we were going to have to do a proxy to get shareholder approval. There is a special rule that applies to mutual funds. When you're merging two mutual funds that are managed by the same advisor, you don't always need to have a proxy. Proxy is a very time-consuming and somewhat expensive process for mutual funds because of the way funds are distributed. It's extremely difficult to get those proxy statements out and out to all the shareholders and achieve your, first you have to achieve a quorum and then you have to get the approval vote. So we were pleased to find out we didn't need a proxy. But the other thing that surprised me is some number of years ago, there were other fund complexes that tried to go down this path and there was actually a denial letter out there. And I thought that from that 2012 denial letter, we were going to have a bigger problem and we really didn't. I think that the industry has evolved. ETFs obviously have grown significantly since that time frame. And then also we had the benefit of the SEC taking a deeper look at how ETFs operate, and that came out of the ETF rule. So that was obviously a huge piece that was probably made them more favorably inclined to this idea.
I'm interested too, just in talking with your shareholders, was there any pushback? I mean, did you get any concerns raised? How did that go?
No, that's a great question. It is the answer to that question. So a couple things. First of all, when we first started thinking about this, I reached out to some of the advisors that have assets in these funds, and 100% of them were in favor of this. And then I'd occasionally get on the phone with a shareholder And I'd ask them the same question. How do you feel about this? What if we did this? And the answers were, again, 100% positive. And then, of course, as we went through the process, I had the chance to speak to several dozen of our shareholders. Not one person expressed any reluctance to do this. Everybody thinks it's a great idea. Now, are there some out there that I didn't talk to? That's quite possible. But let me put it this differently. We've had a number of advisors who are in our other funds, and they're asking me, when are we going to get to these other funds and convert them? This seems to be something that everybody is interested in. And we've had zero pushback. Now, there's been some operational issues we had to sort through, you know, on a couple of account levels. But those are all minor issues. 100% universal acceptance, I guess, is the answer.
You all have already filed to convert a third fund. Are you going to do all the mutual funds? How far are you going with it?
That's not fully determined, but I would say don't be surprised if a year from now we have zero open-end funds and we're an entire ETF family.
Wow. Yeah, it's this is kind of new information. I know you did it, but to hear this sort of testimonial is very interesting. Now, I was with a manager yesterday, they're a mutual fund manager, and we were talking, and they were saying that part of their problem was the 401k plans. Do you have any of your shares in 401k plans or no?
We do, but not a lot. So you're right to raise this issue. That was one of the first things I looked at when we started thinking about this a few years back. We don't have a lot of penetration in the 401k market. We do have some. And in fact, I will tell you, the Guinness Atkinson 401k does invest in the dividend builder. And I called our administrator and said, hey, what happens if this becomes an ETF? And their answer was, not a problem, we can handle it. So we know that there are some retirement platforms that struggle with ETFs or can't handle them, but that's not a universal problem. And there's nothing inherent about ETFs that keeps them out of retirement plans.
So I guess if somebody's out there listening and they're thinking, oh, every mutual fund, do you think this will be something that's targeted to fund families that might not have that big of a 401k presence? Or do you think it might spread and they'll just figure out how to solve that too?
They'll figure out how to solve it. Yeah, there is nothing, to my knowledge, there's nothing inherent about the operations or legal structure of 401ks that's keeping them out of retirement plans.
So there was some questions in 401k plans, and the reason ETFs aren't tend to be in the 401k are, well, besides the fact that you can get the institutional classes cheap, you don't need to intraday trade your 401k. That ETFs stuff. Lose a lot of their superpowers when they go into the 401k that they have outside of it. That said, one of the reasons I would assume is that if you have an ETF in there and you're drip, drip, drip buying, you're constantly paying a spread where you wouldn't pay that with the mutual fund.
Yeah, well, I think, I don't know that that's really that big of an issue. I refer to those as carriage costs. So when you buy a mutual fund, the carriage costs go to the entire fund. That is to say, the bid asks, you put money in a mutual fund, the mutual fund has to deploy that. They're paying commissions, they're paying custody charges, they're paying the bid-ask spread on everything they're buying. Those carriage costs, which rightfully belong to the person coming in, right, are being shared by everybody in the fund. This is one of the benefits of ETFs. So the fact that the carriage cost is more visible in ETF doesn't mean it's being avoided in the mutual fund. To your point about the drip, one of the sort of psychological problems about ETFs versus mutual funds are bought in dollars and ETFs are bought in shares. But that's not an impediment that can't be overcome.
Yeah, so if I can summarize you, mutual funds are internalizing those costs. The ETF, it's externalized, but you're paying it either way. Okay, understood. Right. So that's interesting. That really makes the world much bigger that could do this, because we had said, well, it's probably going to be targeted. But then again, people were pretty bearish that anybody would do it. And now you've got five or six lined up. Anyway, interesting.
So, Jim, if there are 100 mutual funds out there, arbitrarily picking a number, how many of those could you see doing what you did?
Well, in theory, 100, but let's talk about what are some of the impediments for other people doing it. So first of all, I should say that the project that we just went through was the biggest project of my career. And that's because the level of detail that has to be dealt with when the, with this conversion isn't just affecting part of the business. It affects our entire business, from asset management, portfolio construction, trading, compliance, shareholder communications. Every single one of our service providers, the mutual fund was involved, the broker-dealer community was involved, and the level of detail was enormous. We did two funds. Now imagine if you're a mutual fund company with 150 funds and seven share classes each. That is an enormous project. And when you start talking about all of these share classes, and many of the share classes are for different types of retirement plans, they might decide just to leave them as they are because it does work. But for everybody else, I think you're going to decide that the ETF is a better mousetrap. And yes, it's a big project, but it's a project worth doing both for your business and for your shareholders. So could it be 100? Yes. Might it be 80? Could be 80. There's some other issues too. Some funds don't really work well as an ETF. You need to have a liquid pool of investments. Otherwise, the arbitrage mechanism doesn't work. And the create process doesn't
work. So can I...
But it is conceivable that all mutual funds become ETFs, and that might take a decade.
So in the small cap area, you're saying it wouldn't be, if you have a decent sized small cap, converting that to an ETF, then you get into this whole debate they're having with Cathie Wood right now in ARK, which is you're too big to own these small stocks. You're going to push them around and the arbitrage band would widen and it just wouldn't really make sense. Whereas in a mutual fund, you can close, it if you need it. If you're a small cap fund, you get too big and you have capacity issues, you can just close the fund.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess my question too is, now that this has happened, does this sort of pave the way for more? Or as more people do it, does it get easier for the next person to do it? Or is it more just a very individualized kind of process?
It definitely is going to it's paving the way for people to follow in Guinness Atkinson's paths here for sure. We know a lot of advisors who are, obviously there are a number of advisors who've already filed documents indicating that they're going to pursue this. There are a number of other advisors who are talking about it, thinking about it, and looking into it. And there are also people who are thinking about converting other types of either pooled vehicles or assets, types of institutional accounts into ETFs. And I think that's probably coming. And then I think there's a group of people who are looking at converting into non-transparent or semi-transparent ETFs. And I think that's probably, you know, on the horizon. I mean, I haven't seen any filings on those yet, but it's possible.
It's interesting because the non-transparent has been one route to go. A DFA did transparent active. And this is sort of doing it where you bring it everything over. Jim, was it attractive to you? Because you could launch ETFs that are clone-ish off your strategies and still have the tax benefits, but then you've got to start from scratch. Was it attractive to you, the fact that you could bring over the assets as well as the track record?
And the shareholders. I mean, if we had launched a clone, for a shareholder to take advantage of the ETF, they'd have had to realize a taxable gain. So, but yes, we wanted to bring, there were two bedrock principles from the very beginning. We wanted to be able to bring the track record over. We wanted it to be a non-taxable event for our investors. And those were critical. And in just from a business standpoint, I don't really want to be having, you know, two different structures and two different overheads.
So Jim, I have to ask, this being such a seminal event in your career, and, you know, it taking what sounds to be like just a considerable amount of work, what was the point in the process that you were like, what have I gotten myself into? I'm like bashing my head against the wall. What were those things that made you bash your head against the wall?
Well, the thing that worried me throughout the process, even before we started, was what am I going to learn that I wished I knew now? And I was always worried about the unknowable unknown. And in fact, we didn't really stumble across anything major, but I will tell you where I had my sort of moment of panic. We've been having phone calls with everybody in the operation. These are phone calls with like 30 different people from five or six different firms. These phone calls have been going on once a week and then later more than that, going back to like August. Just a tremendous amount of effort, all of these details. And everything just kept looking like it was going fine. The workload kept going up, but we got about 10 days out. And I said to myself, what happens if something goes haywire here? What if this thing just completely fails? And I knew it wasn't going to, but that was sort of like my moment of panic. And I woke up the next day and we were about 9 days out. And I said, you know what, this is going to go fine. And as it turned out, so the conversion happened on a Friday. Last day as a mutual fund was Friday. First day as an ETF was a Monday. So we had that weekend. And I was thinking my phone's going to ring off the hook. I'll have problems all weekend. I got nothing. I had no phone calls over the weekend. We had a 7 a.m. call on Monday morning, a 9 a.m. call on Monday morning just to check in. All of this buildup and all of this work, it was like the whole thing was a whimper at the very end.
It must be like you're describing like what I would imagine reincarnation sounds like.
No, what he's describing is Y2K. Remember, that was a whole thing. That's exactly. There you go. Thank you. My work is done here. I'm going to happy hour.
You're welcome. Yeah. Y2K comparison, way better than reincarnation. But
yeah. Less weird, too.
Less weird. Yeah. I went super meta and you kept it real. So thank you for that. So Jim, I have to ask, since this happened, how many phone calls of former peers in the mutual fund world have you been getting?
Several dozen. Emails, phone calls. It's surprising because, you know, you're sort of just working away, and you don't realize that so many people are watching. But a lot of people were, and a lot of people have noticed. So I've been in touch with people I hadn't been in touch with for 5 or 10 years.
And Alex, how about for you, since you are the trailblazing lawyer that got this done?
Yeah, I've heard from a lot of people. You know, I think lawyers, you know, mutual fund lawyers, we usually connect every year or two. We all go to a big conference together. So that conference didn't happen. I don't think it even happened last year. Sure, it happened virtually this year. I think, you know, I have a lot of drink tickets coming my way next year.
By the way, just speaking of mutual fund lawyers, I think of the word compliance when I think of you guys. And I think of someone who's just constantly saying no and just seems like, I don't know, but you seem pretty cool. Like, you seem like you're a little more optimistic. Can you talk about the sort of trying to work in between the need to market and the rules?
Well, I mean, first of all, thank you. There are plenty of times where I have said no to Jim, and he'll vouch for that. It's always attention. Mutual funds are extremely regulated. This investment companies are highly regulated when you look into the scheme of how things operate in the US, right? And there are very significant and very specific rules around mutual fund marketing. And that is a combination of statutory elements of the statute itself, regulations that were adopted under the Investment Company Act, and pieces of the Investment Advisors Act. And then there's this whole body of law, which is in no action letters and other SEC pronouncements. And they are very precise about what you can and cannot say with respect to mutual funds and performance. And compliance with those requirements is obviously a big piece of this picture. Now, the ETF rule came out a couple of years ago. It also has a series of very specific compliance obligations on the fund manager. It requires very precise information to be put up on the website every day if you're operating pursuant to that rule, which these funds are under that rule. That's Rule 6C11. And, you know, you have to, compliance is, as Jim said, this is touching every piece of the advisory business, and compliance is part of that. And compliance is always part of a mutual fund business too. So it's really trying to just make sure you don't have conflicts. The two sets of schemes harmonize. They're not exactly on all fours. And we are in the middle of this soup because there's a new rule that applies to investment advisor marketing that has just been adopted by the SEC. It's going to be going into compliance shortly. So we're sort of retooling this all. But, you know, the standardized information that you see, whether it's about a mutual fund or an exchange traded fund, what you're seeing out there is put together in accordance with a very specific set of accounting and financial reporting rules. And that's what you had with the mutual fund prospectus. And now you have that with the ETF. In the case of these conversions, The ETF is the accounting and performance survivor in these merger transactions. So they adapt the performance of the predecessor mutual fund.
So I have to ask if there are as many mutual funds going to make this jump as Jim sort of indicated, you know, he thinks might. How many mutual fund lawyers are going to jump over to become ETF lawyers?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of mutual fund lawyers who are also ETF lawyers. It doesn't necessarily, we don't sort of separate ourselves into those buckets. I think, you know, there are a lot of fund lawyers who are representing or advising fund complexes or boards of directors of funds who are already focused on these transactions and looking into them. So I think that, you know, there's, as I said, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. The concept of converting an existing pool of assets into the ETF is appealing because it's much harder, it feels much harder for the advisor to start from zero. When you're converting an existing pool or an existing account, you already have a performance history, you know your strategy works. Question is the ETF wrapper the right distribution vehicle?
Well, one thing that I'm wondering just about the conversion environment in general is from questions that I've gotten on Twitter or that kind of thing, people who maybe are mutual fund shareholders and they're wondering like, oh, is my mutual fund going to become an ETF? Or just the idea that that could sneak up on you. But there is a lot of disclosure involved in it, right? I mean, people listening shouldn't be like either worried or, you know, freaked that suddenly something's going to happen without them knowing.
They'll definitely notice. Yeah, they're going to get an 80-page document in the mail. So,
and then they'll get less capital gains distributions. They'll notice that.
That's exactly right. And I think if a shareholder is worried about that, they should be thinking this is a good thing for them, not a bad thing. They'll have an ETF one morning where they previously had a mutual fund, and it'll be on their statement. Most of these investors have their funds currently through a broker dealer, so they'll place their you know, when they want to redeem, they'll do what they normally do. They'll just call their broker dealer and exit.
Okay, let me just we'll put the thing out there that any investor would want to know here, which is what downside, if any, do you see here?
Well, I don't really. Particularly in an era of zero commissions. Now, if you're a client at a brokerage firm that still charges commissions, that's a bit of a negative. You know, you do have to deal with, you know, figuring out what kind of order you're going to put in. So I can put in a limit order or a market order, and I would advise a limit order. But beyond that, I mean, you should be realizing cost savings. You should be gaining tax efficiency. You should be gaining transparency. And you should be gaining the ability to have intraday liquidity.
Let me just, I put a question in the chat to the guys on my team to see if they had any questions. It's a good question, actually. This would be from Athanasios in London. Hey, Athanasios, thanks for listening. I feel like a radio show. He has a question for Jim. How do you feel, though, about having to be transparent now?
Because that's a good question.
Yeah, right.
Our shop tends to be transparent. By the way, that's our sort of style. That's a different question from our portfolio being fully transparent every day. We are a low turnover shop. That's part of how we manage money. And we don't mind people seeing our holdings. So that sort of raises a question of, okay, what about front running? The way we've set it up, when we make a change in the portfolio, it will be completed before the end of the day and before people realize what has happened. So we have to report our holdings every day, put them on our website every day after the market closes, and we distribute the basket through the NSEC system to the market participants. But by the time they see that it's different from the day before, we're done. So we're not worried about people front running.
We touched on this, but we're looking at, say, by the way, I mean, the fact that you're getting all these calls and emails speaks volumes about what we're probably going to see. But the mutual fund industry is, I want to say, of the equity and fixed income sides together, is, I think, ballpark 12 trillion, somewhere in there, 12, 13 trillion. What percentage of that do you think is convertible?
I don't know the answer to that question. Part of that would relate to how much is in fixed income and how many of those fixed income funds would be convertible. It's not quite as easy for some of the fixed income vehicles to become ETFs. That's not to say they couldn't be, but there's some things to be thought through. And then there's some derivative-based strategies that may not work as ETFs. If this happens, which is to say, if there's a long-term trend to convert mutual funds to ETFs, which is what I think will happen, it is not going to happen quickly. It's going to be a potentially a decade-long process, because some of the ones that are more difficult are going to have to take longer to figure out. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no.
And you're asking me to predict the future, but I can't really speak for the rest of the industry, but I just sort of look at this from my perspective and from a shareholder perspective. The ETF is just a better mousetrap. And if we can deliver a better product, we should all be thinking about doing that. Now, might it be difficult? In some cases, yes, and increasingly difficult for certain firms, and some strategies might not make it, might pass the test.
All right. So, Jim, what about for like a big mutual fund player like a Fidelity? How much of this conversation is going to go down there?
Well, I don't have any information about what's going on inside of Fidelity, but I have heard that mutual fund executives at other large firms are watching this very closely. And again, it's almost a case-by-case basis. There's a lot of business complexity at a larger firm. The more products you have, the more esoteric the products are, the less liquid they are. I mean, there's a whole lot of things to think about, not to mention multiple share classes, distribution channels, et cetera. So it's impossible for me to say what might be happening at a particular firm. All I can tell you is I know from multiple sources that the senior executives of very large asset management firms are looking at what we're doing.
And you're the guinea pig.
Listen, Joel, I tweeted out the other day, divs. I was like, this little guy made history. It's, you know, going to be the first one over. There's been all kinds of conversions. Canada's done this. In the U.S., there's been, I think, closed-end fund to ETF. But there has never been this. And so divs definitely has broken ground. It's probably going to make the history book. So congratulations, Jim and Alex. I think you've earned a couple drink tickets, Alex.
Thanks.
Plus Guinness. By the way, Jim, do you get free Guinness?
Well, that's just a perk.
So you don't need drink tickets if you hang out with Jim.
Jim, Alex, thank you so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find Claire at CFB_18. For more on Guinness Atkinson funds, check out Smart ETFs. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.